From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm David Watts Barton. It's been nearly a year since Mayor Kevin Johnson and the city of Sacramento got a deadline from the NBA to figure out a way to keep the Kings in Sacramento. That deadline is Thursday, and as of yesterday, it looks as though the city may make it. Joining me now to explain the so-called term sheet and where we go from here is Chris Lehane, who has managed the PR for the mayor's Think Big Sacramento campaign to keep the Kings here and to build an arena to house them. Chris Lehane, welcome to Insight.
Thanks. Thanks for having me back.
Yes, well, our pleasure. We have a little clip here of the mayor from yesterday in Orlando, and we wanted to just play that quickly.
Sure.
There was a gap of essentially about $80 million, $80, $85 million. That gap got closed today. That's the most important part of the deal. The Blues upped their commitment from $50 million to over $70 million. AEG, which was in at $50 million, they upped their commitment significantly. The NBA contributed. So everybody did their part. You know, the city had already stretched with this parking, and I think the Blues and everybody else did their part to make sure that this was a win-win, and I think Sacramento should be extremely proud.
Chris Lehane, what are the contours of the deal? We know that there were some gaps that were closed. How does that lay out right now between all the interested parties?
Yeah, it's a great question, and obviously a lot of the details will be coming out over the next few days. And as I understand it, council members are going to be briefed today, and by Thursday we should have a formalized term sheet, which will be the actual real document for folks to view. But you know, yesterday was really about cementing the framework of the deal. And as the mayor said, you know, it really is a win-win-win. The deal really does reflect all the principles that the city, you know, entered these negotiations in, right? This was always supposed to be about jobs and economic development. We needed to make sure the taxpayers were protected, which was translated into no imposition of new taxes. And finally, we needed to make sure that the general fund was protected. And I think, you know, I'll sort of tick through the major deal points at a relatively high level, but you will see that, you know, all of those principles or all that criteria is really baked into it. So, you know, first, the deal does truly reflect the type of public-private partnership that we had been talking about, the mayor had been talking about, the council for months, which
right.
There's a contribution from the city, which will be, you know, 90% of it roughly is in the form of the parking concession that we've talked about, leasing the city's parking and then using that money as the city's contribution. There'll be some land in there as well, but the land is relatively modest. You know,
And when we say land, we're talking about selling land to raise money, selling
city
property.
Well, combination, and again, the, you know, somewhere like 92 or 93% of the city's contribution really is the parking piece. But there's I bifurcate the land into two elements. One is, you know, the city contributing the land it owns at the rail yards for where the facility will be built. Now, since it's going to be a city-owned or public-owned facility, you know, if we're building it on our own land. And then the second would be some other parcels of land in and around the city that we would potentially want to put out to generate some additional economics. But again, the vast bulk of this is really the parking concession that we've looked at. Then you have, you know, the operator's contribution. That's correct. And going into Orlando, we had always felt in the public-private model that we were looking at that the operator had already represented that it was willing to commit at a level that we thought was appropriate and consistent with our models. And then the last piece was the team contribution. Mm-hmm. And as the mayor indicated, and I think they deserve enormous credit, you know, the Maloof family really did step up, you know, over the course of the weekend and come in at the level that we were looking for. So that was sort of point one of the deal points. You know, point two is that, you know, when you actually take a step back, and again, I don't want to confuse people with too many numbers, but, you know, as people begin to see the details of this, particularly when the term sheet comes out, you know, it will be clear that the combination of the AEG contribution and the Maloof contribution will really represent the single biggest investment you've had from the private sector in any of these recent public-private partnerships with NBA arenas. There's been about eight that have been done, you know, really over the last 4 or 5 years. And, you know, this one is going to sort of redefine the model because of the level that the operator and the team are coming in at. And again, those details will be out over the next few days, but it is a very, very impressive number.
Now, some of the questions that have come up, particularly about the city, the NBA, we figure, can take care of itself. AEG seems to be doing pretty well.
Yep.
The Maloofs have, there have been a lot of question marks around the Maloofs. They've been selling off a lot of their assets. They still owe the city of Sacramento quite a bit of money. How are the Maloofs able to step up with these kinds of amounts of money? We're talking, and we didn't really get the numbers. $75 million, is that right for them? $75 million
You're certainly in the neighborhood. We had always been looking to get a contribution over $70 million, and that's where we've ended up. You know, there have been various reports out there at 75. I think that, you know, is generally where you'll see the number. Again, the term sheet will be out on Thursday with the specifics. But
and then the second $75 million that they mentioned was against proceeds over the next 30 years from the arena.
Yeah, and let me get to that, because so people understand exactly what that is. But that $75 million is a very, you know, significant contribution from the family. I have to say, one of the things that I was really struck by over the weekend, and I think people saw it yesterday in terms of Gavin Maloof's, you know, comments on camera, was how emotionally connected the family is to the city and the community. I for one, had not fully appreciated that until I was in the room with them, you know, over a couple of days. You know, there are probably better deals out there in terms of NBA arenas from their perspective, in terms of what other teams have gotten. But they've recognized that what Sacramento has put on the table is unprecedented, that it was a fair deal, and that it was a good deal. And this wasn't about Sacramento compared to someone else. This is whether Sacramento could get to a place where they could do a deal that would protect the economics of their family. But clearly, this is a lot more than dollars and cents for them. They have an emotional connection to the community. And, you know, it got fairly emotional, you know, inside those negotiations and those private meetings. And I think some of that, you know, even expressed itself, when Gavin was on camera later on and teared up and was very emotional.
And you also have George, the third family member, not so keen on the idea.
Well, I think that, you know, if you and again, I don't want to get into sort of psychoanalyzing people, but, you know, if you look at, you know, at least based on what I saw in the room, you know, you had three brothers. I think, you know, Joe and Gavin are sort of the heart and soul, and George, I think, has historically been the numbers guy. And I think he, and appropriately so and justifiably so, wanted to make sure that the family's economics, you know, were protected. This is a family investment. It's their money. And I think once he got to a place where he was comfortable that the economics would work, that this would be a competitive team, that they'd be able to put a good product on the floor, that the family, would be able to justify its investment. Once he got to that point, I think he was very comfortable with the deal. Again, I don't want to speak for him or the family. They are more than capable of doing that themselves. I'm just merely reflecting what I saw in the room. Uh-huh. But, you know, as I said, and the mayor made this point any number of times, as did the commissioner, right? You know, Sacramento had stepped up. And once Sacramento stepped up in a way that it had never really done before, the family was excited and committed to being in the city. And I think that's one of the reasons we got the result that we got over the last 3 days.
And at what point will the family actually be committed? When will something be signed where everybody can, if they're pro arena, can sort of breathe a sigh of relief on this?
Yeah, well,
thing?
I mean, look, I think a big sigh of relief took place, you know, yesterday. That, you know, is a framework that everyone agreed to. Mm-hmm. When you see the term sheet, and again, that's, you know, literally in the process of being finalized. And formalized so that it can be made public, that will it's a pretty straightforward deal. I mean, there's not a lot of complexity to this. And so what happens is, you know, that gets presented and the council gets to vote, you know, on March 6th to move forward with the RFP process for the leasing of the parking.
Right.
And at that point, you know, both sides, you know, are effectively, you know, locked into this going forward. I mean, you know, it's non-binding for everyone. But, you know, the team is committing to being here going forward, and the city is effectively committing, the public's effectively committing, you know, to building the arena along the terms of what we've discussed.
All right.
So it's a great opportunity to look. I mean, at the end of the day, it's still really important to remember what this is really about. You know, it is about fundamentally changing Sacramento. This is going to be an enormous amount of jobs, 4,000 between now and 2015, right? It is going to economically transform downtown Sacramento. And I just think for the psychology of the city, this is a city that really acted big, came up big, delivered, and everyone in Sacramento should be enormously proud of what has been accomplished.
All right. Well, thanks, Chris Lehane of Think Big Sacramento, and good luck in the next week or two.
Thanks, and thanks for following all of this.
My pleasure. And joining me here in the studio right now is Melissa Corker, a city politics reporter for Politics Reporter for the Sacramento Press. Welcome, Melissa.
Thank you.
Boy, there are an awful lot of things to cover, and we don't have a lot of time. You've been looking at this for a long time. What do the politics of this look like at the city council in Sacramento, because it has been such a divided council on so many issues? And the mayor got a good vote recently, but this is still...
Right. I think the biggest thing is there are a lot of questions that city council members want answered. And those answers aren't going to be easy to come by.
And what are the questions?
Things like, the details, first and foremost, as Chris was just saying, the term sheet isn't actually going to be in anybody's hands until Thursday. And they want to see the real numbers, the actual numbers. And they want to know for sure that, first and foremost, that the general fund will actually get the backfill that's being promised. That's huge for a lot of the council members.
Explain what that means, backfill.
The parking inventory for this city generates approximately $9 million a year in revenue for the city. Mm-hmm. But when they lease that out, part of this leasing opportunity is the city is going to get an upfront lump sum cash, and they're going to be giving up that revenue over the course of the lease term. So that's $9 million a year that will not be going into the general fund.
Which is every penny of which is needed.
Every penny is needed.
And then some.
Exactly. And so council members want to know, how are we going to recoup that money? Where is that going to be coming from? And so when the term sheet comes out, they're going to be looking for those numbers, and they're going to want a guarantee of some sort that that money is not just lost. When the mayor had his press conference Tuesday last week, there were five city council members standing up there with him, which by all appearances says, hey, we've got the support. We need to make this go forward. But there are still some of those council members, Daryl Fong for one, that wants the details first. And he just was quoted recently of saying that voting on this without reading it is like taking a test without doing your homework. So they're not locked in yet, and when the vote discussion comes up on March 6th, it's going to be a pretty hefty discussion.
And there's actually a vote going on right now at the County Board of Supervisors, because
yes,
they own three parking lots in that area that would be very useful and could be rented out at night. And it sort of raises the regional aspect of this, because the rest of the region doesn't seem to have really stepped up at all on this. And mm-hmm. We'll see what the Board of Supervisors does. But right now, everybody's scrambling for money, and they're looking at Sacramento building something nice for them to come visit, but they're not feeling a lot of responsibility for it.
Right. And that's another question that has been asked, and council members, Ms. Sheedy and Ms. Pinnell, among others, have said, hey, where's our regional input? This was going to be, everybody involved, and we've got, where's everybody else stepping up? And this is one of the ways that it does bring in that regional aspect. If the county Board of Supervisors votes today to support that idea of contributing to the effort with their parking facilities, then that's a step in the right direction as far as having others in the region participating. And it means, from what I can understand, from what I see, 1,500 parking spaces will be available from those three lots, to the tune of roughly $3 million revenue mm-hmm. contribution annually. Mm-hmm. So it's not a huge number, but it is something, and it is a step in the right direction.
We're also on the arena, the public vote, the public support for this. I mean, in 2005 or 6, there was the vote on Q&R, and it went down 80-20%.
Right,
I mean,
crash and burn.
Yeah, total disaster in terms of the arena. What is the sense? I mean, there isn't going to be a public vote on this. It's all down to the city council, right?
The moment, no.
There's been some push to make that happen, but what's the sense? What is your sense of the public's desire for this or not, given all the other problems that the city has?
Wow. That is certainly a depends on who you ask question, mm-hmm. because for those that have wanted an arena and first of all, Kings fans in the first place, yes, definitely we want arena, whatever it takes, let's go. And other people will say, we'd like it as long as we don't pay for it. Let's make it not out of our pocket directly. And other folks are not even concerned about it for basketball, but as this is going to be a huge urban center, it's got benefits beyond basketball. So yeah, let's make it work, whatever we have to do. Do I think there's a 70% support, 80% overwhelming? I don't really think I can speak to that. And, mm-hmm. you know, when you look at the polls, one poll will say, oh, everybody wants it. Another poll will say, nobody wants it. I think it's hard really to pinpoint where that is at the moment.
speaking with Melissa Corker of the Sacramento Press about the arena. And I should note that we are going to have some people on tomorrow that who are anti-arena people. So we will hear some from them as well. And you're neutral, of course.
Yeah.
But thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
For more of the coverage on the arena deal, we've been covering it for quite a while. It's on our website, capradio.org/insight, and you are listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the odds of a bankruptcy in Stockton.
On the web at capradio.org, this is Capital Public Radio, looking for your contributions at 1-800-800-5867 or capradio.org. My name's Nick Bruner, and with Marianne Russ.
What an important discussion that we've just been listening to about the arena deal. Huge news this week for Sacramento, for the entire community. It doesn't get too much bigger than this, and what a perfect forum for a discussion about such a big topic. Where else do you find that sort of in-depth information, the pros and cons? As you just heard David Watts Barton say, they're going to be hearing from folks on the other side of the issue tomorrow. You just don't find that anywhere else. You only get that here at Capital Public Radio. To help that continue, contribute today at 800-800-5867 or go online, capradio.org.
Along with your contributions, we get support from ScholarShare Savings Plan, a way for Californians to save for college. Details on tax advantages and other benefits at scholarshare.com. TIAA CREF Tuition Financing Incorporated Program Manager. And from The Experience, a local multi-faith organization sharing spiritual values between faiths to bring about a more peaceful world through worship and collaboration, on the web at experiencesacramento.org. Now, we understand that not everybody's in a position to contribute to public radio financially during our fund drives, or perhaps it's just not as much as they like. We get comment after comment with donations of $5, $20, one-time donations that say, I wish we could contribute more. Well, listen, we completely respect that fact and where you are financially. It's one of the reasons we don't have a minimum amount for membership. You can make a one-time gift, or you can break up an annual contribution into monthly installments with our Evergreen program. Either way, thanks very much for supporting Insights and Capital Public Radio. You do that by calling 1-800-800-5867 or at our website, capradio.org.
We know that you contribute to Capital Public Radio because of the programming, great shows such as Insight. But when we can throw an extra incentive in there for you, we always like to do that. One that we are offering this fund drive is the Capital Public Radio I Heart NPR t-shirts. It's gorgeous. It's a very luxurious soft fabric, 100% cotton. And they're short sleeve, they're gray. They, of course, have your Capital Public Radio logo and then the iHeart NPR as well. And you can ask for that when you contribute $120 or more, or just tell us you want the whole contribution to benefit the station. Either way, call us at 800-800-5867 or go online. It's very, very quick. capradio.org.
It's listener support, it's listener involvement that pays for your favorite programs here at Capital Public Radio. Do that now with a contribution. 1-800-800-5867 or on the web at capradio.org. And thanks.
You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. It's time to find out what's in the news today with our senior editor, Alan Ray. He joins us from the newsroom. Alan, what's up?
Well, good morning, David. If you're a water planner or manager in California, figure this will be another day to read them and weep. The Department of Water Resources will take a new Sierra snowpack survey, and the results are not likely to be encouraging. Even with recent snow and a bit more in the Sierra forecast, snow levels are far below normal and small fractions of last year. And with all that, the snow that's there has not been loaded with water. Snowpack water content's barely a third of normal. But the DWR will take the survey, and we'll have the story this afternoon on All Things Considered. The big political news today is the Michigan primary. Mitt Romney, born there, his father governor there, but Romney has spent much of the campaign trying to convince the home folks that he's a homeboy. People who read the political tea leaves and entrails say a loss in Michigan could be devastating to Romney's presidential aspirations. There's also a primary in Arizona, but virtually everybody thinks that's a Romney gimme. NPR coverage of the day's political events begins at 3:30. We'll have full primary coverage beginning at 6. It all starts this afternoon at 3:30 on All Things Considered from Capital Public Radio.
All right. Thanks, Alan.
My pleasure.
The city of Stockton's finances are a mess. The collapse of the housing market that had driven the city's growth has revealed structural problems and even downright corruption in the city's politics, like sunken car wrecks revealed by a receding tide. The city is overcommitted on every side, and its tax base is shrinking fast with little hope in sight. Bankruptcy was floated last week as a possibility, which would make it the biggest municipal bankruptcy in the country. Joining me to talk about the particulars of the Stockton case is Michael Fitzgerald, a lifelong Stocktonian, a columnist for the Stockton Record, and a regular visitor to Insight. Welcome back, Michael.
Good morning, David.
It's weird. You were on the show a week ago, and we were just talking about the possibility of bankruptcy, and a couple days later, there it was.
Now it's all coming to a head. The council will vote tonight. The council is expected to vote to approve not bankruptcy, but to go into that new 560 process. Let me refresh your memory. Mm-hmm. When Vallejo went bankrupt several years ago, labor took a big haircut, and labor up and down the state was very spooked by that. So they got a legislator to pass a law saying that basically makes it more difficult for cities to declare bankruptcy. First now, unless there's an absolute existential crisis, cities have to go into something called a confidential mediation or a 560 hearing because the law was AB 560. And so tonight the council will vote on whether or not to take that step and go into a mediation with all of their creditors, not just the employee unions that they've been butting heads with, but the big banks and bondholders and others that owe the city $5 million or more.
And you said butting heads. That is almost putting it nicely, the relationship between public safety unions and the city, isn't it?
Well, the fire department sued the city but settled out of court. The police department is still suing the city. And you'll recall that they also bought the house next to the city manager, and what they say is just an innocent investment. But what one judge said seems like a form of stalking.
When I read that, I was amazed that they did that.
Well, I think it casts light on what the big fight is going to be tonight. The new player is the former city manager, Dwayne Milnes. Mr. Milnes was city manager of Stockton from 1991 to 2001, and he still lives in this community. Mr. Milnes feels unfairly tarnished by what's coming out of City Hall right now, which essentially is saying that during the 1990s, during Mr. Milnes' tenure, the city made agreements with labor that were unsustainable, that Mr. Milnes and company gave the store away. Mm-hmm. So he's expected to show up to the council tonight to argue that it's not necessary to go into the 560 hearing, that the city could doesn't need to do the most drastic step first, that it could really just sit down and have informal negotiations with the retirees, with the labor unions. Now, remember what we just said, that both of the city's main labor unions have sued the city, and we're basically at an impasse with the police right now. So it's hard to see how those talks could really be fruitful.
Yeah, because if people are in court cases on one level, they're not going to be going in and working something out on another level.
Exactly. If you sue somebody, you become enemies or adversaries with them. Mr. Milne's tone is, let me read you a quote from today's paper.
Okay.
The council has been panicked and does not know to whom to turn for an alternative view of the universe. They are clinging to the person who is promising to get them out of the Armageddon he has defined. Now, that's Milnes commenting on the current city manager, Bob Dice, but in an almost arrogant and condescending manner to the council, that they're panicked. And in actuality, they're plenty worried, but panicked, nothing could be further from the truth. Stockton hired a CFO that dug into the city's books for a year, and Stockton then double-checked itself by hiring an outside consultant firm to go over the books one more time, and both of them have come to the conclusion that it's as bad as they think it is.
Well, then, so why do you say they're not panicked? It sounds like a perfect recipe for panic.
Well, what Mr. Milnes means by panic is that the council is making an irrational decision by voting to proceed into the 560 hearing,
right.
That it's not as bad as all that, that it could be resolved short of that. It's Mr. Milne's position that if the city, one of the things they're going to vote on tonight, they're going to vote on a package of 8 recommendations. The 3 main ones are to go into the 560 hearing, but to suspend millions of dollars in debt payments to bondholders, Mm-hmm. And also, and this is interesting, to authorize the city manager and the city attorney to conduct an investigation into Stockton's books. They won't say who they want to investigate, but it's a good guess that they want to go after at least the independent auditors that have been helping Stockton all along and who appear to have signed off on sham financials and perhaps seek some recourse from them in civil court. But the point Mr. Millens is making is that if you suspend debt payments, you're in effect declaring bankruptcy.
Right.
However,
it seems like a legal delaying tactic that's been forced on them.
Well, it's bankruptcy light, and no one has been here before because this law has only been on the books for a couple months and it's never been tried.
Okay.
So Stockton is entering legal and statutory terra incognita and is going to be maybe the guinea pig for this new law.
Michael Fitzgerald is with the Stockton Record, and we're talking about the likelihood of a municipal bankruptcy in Stockton. And Michael, if you could hang on the phone for a second, we also have with us John Gramlich, who is staff writer for the Stateline Pew Center on the States, and he's here to talk a little bit about municipal bankruptcies in general. John Gramlich, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me on, David.
John, you've been listening to this. I'm assuming that as somebody who's interested in municipal bankruptcies, you've been following Stockton pretty carefully. But just in general, how is a municipal bankruptcy different from a personal or a business bankruptcy?
It's different just in the sense that it goes to the judicial realm, of course, but unlike a business bankruptcy, the judge in the case really does not have the authority to restructure things on his or her own. It's still up to the city and the elected officials to come to terms to a solution in the end.
Okay, and one of the many factors that they need to deal with are the unions and the pensions and a lot of these promises that have been made out into the even not foreseeable future. How does that play into a municipal bankruptcy? Is that the biggest part of it?
I mean, that's going to have to be decided, you know, during the negotiations. Everyone's going to be at the table and everyone's going to, you know, state their case, and the judge is going to, you know, sort of mediate among that, but it all plays into it. I mean, in some other places where this has come up, it's been other issues. It hasn't been pensions, but pensions and public worker benefits is what you're seeing a lot of these days.
Mm-hmm. And now, what about this new law and this sort of intermediate step that's been introduced? How's that changed?
Yeah, you know what? I don't actually know too much about that, but it's interesting. I was reading up on it earlier, and it's not like anything I've seen elsewhere. I mean, it sounds like the state legislature there in California has basically passed it in order to slow down what they think might be a flood of municipal bankruptcies, or at least make it harder for municipalities to do that. In most states, there is, you know, the state needs to offer some kind of permission before a municipality can go bankrupt. But California is not one of those states. California is actually just one of 15 states where, up until this law was passed, a municipality could go bankrupt on its own without any input from the state. And so I guess what it sounds like is happening is that the state wants to, you know, stop that in its tracks and make sure that doesn't happen.
And of course, I would guess that the motivation for stopping that is that if you start having whole cities declaring bankruptcy, it's going to make the foreclosure crisis and personal bankruptcies look like a very small wave, let's say.
Yeah, I mean, there's some debate as to what the impact is on the state level. I mean, clearly it's not a good thing. I don't think anybody's going to argue that it's a good thing if a bunch of cities start going bankrupt. But there is some debate over whether, you know, California could see its own credit rating get downgraded or its own borrowing costs increase because a number of its municipalities have declared bankruptcy. I mean, some people who watch the bond markets will say American Airlines went bankrupt, but of course that was just confined to American Airlines. It wasn't every airline that faced repercussions from that. And so I think there's an argument out there that says that investors are smart enough to know the difference between the state and the municipality. But I think the states probably don't want to take that chance.
I'm speaking with John Gramlich, who is a staff writer for the Pew Center on the States and Stateline. And he's here talking about municipal bankruptcies. Also, Michael Fitzgerald, the Stockton Record. Michael, if banks were bankruptcy goes through, how is it looking that the public pensions are going to play out? I mean, how are they going? If you have a lot of people losing their pensions or having greatly diminished pensions in Stockton, that just continues the financial problems of the city, doesn't it?
Well, that's unclear. The pension liability is $450 million minimum, so it's a It's a bill that's pushing $500 million that nobody's put a dollar down on. So, you know, we're talking about bankruptcy, but the real next step is the 560 hearing. I think that's where the city's going to go. And remember that a 560 hearing, unlike bankruptcy, is not a mandatory proceeding. The creditors of the city do not have to show up. So I think it's in everybody's interest to show up, but they don't have to show up and they don't have to agree. Any agreements that emerge from the 560 hearing are voluntary. Oh. So the retirees know that they're going to get a haircut. Everybody knows they're going to get a haircut. But the question is, does the 560 hearing hold out the possibility of a constructive resolution of Stockton's fiscal dilemma? You know, it was a labor-backed measure. So I've been observing labor in this town, and they've had to make a lot of sacrifices. And one of the reasons that the city wants to go into this is because it's got three options. Number one, you can cut the city workforce more. Well, they've already cut 50 firemen and 100 policemen and a quarter of the city workforce, and they feel that they're on the verge of ceasing to be a functioning municipality. Mm-hmm. They're going to turn the streets over to the crooks. The second thing is to pass a tax. Well, it's 19% unemployment here, and we're the foreclosure capital of the United States, so it's very unlikely that the citizens would vote for a tax. The third is to go into these 560 negotiations, in which there is a chance for a mutually agreed-upon resolution to this without a judge telling you this is what you're going to have to swallow. So it's interesting that the labor this is a labor-backed measure, but labor here in the first test case of this law seems to be opposing it. There's a sort of mentality of insolvency denial out there. The head of the police union says the city has a couple million dollars it's not telling people about. We've heard that before. So really, when they all get in there and the city opens up the books, maybe this can be resolved this side of bankruptcy.
Michael, I also wanted to ask you, because people have mentioned it to me. They look at this and they look at the a lot of the stories on this come accompanied by a picture of an arena on the riverfront. And how much was the building? And, you know, obviously Sacramento's looking at an arena right now. How much of the financial problems of Stockton could be traced back to all those expenditures on the waterfront, on the arena, things like that?
That's one of the major components of Stockton's debt. Stockton, in fact, created unsustainable employee contracts in the 1990s, and then in the first decade of the 2000s, the first decade of this century, it ran up $319 million in debt. The arena was a major component of that debt. The ballpark, the Mayor's Safe Neighborhood initiatives, in which they went out and they did a lot of infrastructure, but that wasn't redevelopment as it's really conceived to be, which is to create private sector investment and economic development. So the arena, the marina, the ballpark, this downtown restaurant and Cineplex, those were very expensive debt issues, and the city is now saying that it's going to have to halt payment on those bonds for the time being.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Michael Fitzgerald of the Stockton Record, thanks so much. And John Gramlich at the State Lines Pew Center on the Stage, thanks so much for calling in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Authors on the Move. We'll be right back.
More from Inside in just a minute on listener-supported Capital Public Radio, streaming at capradio.org. And today we're inviting you to become a contributor to this program and Capital Public Radio overall. When you do that, you'll be accomplishing at least two things. You'll be helping to ensure that Insight and all the programs that you listen to on this station will be around for years to come. Plus, you'll be helping us build an even better service as we move ahead into the future. It's a big, powerful action when you make a contribution, when you step up and take ownership of these programs. We hope that you'll do it now online at capradio.org or by phone, 800-800-5867.
Insight is one of a kind. Today we've heard about the all-important arena deal in Sacramento, the economic struggles for the city of Stockton. You hear a huge variety of programming on Insight. Sometimes they'll be talking about beer, as they were yesterday. Other times we'll be hearing from an artist or hearing from an author or listening to an artist, better yet. And all of this is programmed with you in mind. It's a local focus. It's not just what's happening in the national and international communities. It's what's happening in your community. And that's why it's so important that you become a contributor and not not just a listener to Insight and to Capital Public Radio. We're asking you to do it today. Do it this morning, 800-800-5867, or just go online at capradio.org.
Some heavy hitters in the local brewing industry were featured on this program yesterday, as well as in a feature piece by our food reporter Elaine Korn during Morning Edition and All Things Considered yesterday as well. It's fun to tap into cultural events happening here. So it's not just all the hard news, it's the fun stuff as well that we cover with just as much thought and consideration and what goes into these, because that's important too. And we think it's a really well-rounded set of stories that you hear on a regular basis on Capital Public Radio, and they're paid for through contributions by you, listeners to this program. 1-800-800-5867 or capradio.org to make that contribution. In addition, we get support from Sacramento Country Day School, a pre-K through 12th grade college preparatory school offering small classes and dedicated teachers, where academics, art, music, and sports are a part of every school day. Information at saccds.org. And from Johnasquaga's Nugget in Reno, presenting live music in the Celebrity Showroom featuring Bela Fleck and the original Flecktones, Saturday, March 10th. Details and tickets at janugget.com. And Wawa Nisa Insurance. Information on auto insurance is at wawanisaus.com. Help chip in for Insight now with a contribution, say $10 a month on our Evergreen program. You can do that at our website, capradio.org, or when you call us up at 1-800-800-5867. Again, 1-800-800-5867 or capradio.org. Thanks.
You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. 45 notable California writers will convene at Sacramento's 10th annual literary event, Authors on the Move. This year's event, to be held Saturday evening at the Hyatt Regency downtown, is themed The Plot Thickens, The Future of Libraries. The event is a fundraiser for local libraries and will be attended by some big-name local authors, two of whom are with me now to discuss the event. They are Lisa Luz, who is on the phone right now from New York City. Welcome, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. It's Lutz, by the way.
Lutz, okay. John LaCroix, who's right here in our studio. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
John, why are you participating in this event?
Well, you know, I was the very first author of the very first Authors on Move 10 years ago. And I think April Butcher, who runs the Sacramento County Library Foundation, thought it was about time for, you know, me to come back and pretend like I'm, you know, still relevant.
How's that going for you?
It's going okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Lisa, what about you?
Why am I involved? I was asked, and I usually say yes to everything.
Have you been involved before?
Yes, I was there last year as one of the authors that sort of table hops in a sort of speed dating for authors.
Uh-huh. And that was the format of the event, is that you're all sort of stationed around the...
Yeah, we go for each course of the meal, we move to a new table. We spend about 10 or 15 minutes with each table, and hopefully we get some personal stuff done and get them to know us, and we get to know the patrons. It's great. It's really a fun night.
And what do people want to know when they meet you? They've been reading your books. They feel they know you and they're fans. What do people usually want to talk about?
Well, if I base it on real characters and where I get my ideas, and I'm sure Lisa gets the same questions I get. It's pretty interesting, actually. Every time there's going to be seven questions about, do you write about real people and where do you get your ideas? And then there'll be two or three questions that you've never heard before that are fantastic.
Uh-huh.
I often get, who are you? But
That's
do
nice.
You really do this? Yeah.
No. They're like, oh, who are you? What do you write? So I often have to do the song and dance, but I'm hoping this year that I'm a keynote. People have prepared. Uh-huh. They know I'm somewhat relevant.
Now, do you live in, Lisa, do you live in Sacramento?
No, I live in San Francisco.
You do? Okay. And are most of the authors at the event going to be people who live in Sacramento?
I think it's mostly Northern California authors, yes.
Yes, yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
Okay. And we should mention some of the other authors are Tysa Frank. I don't know how to pronounce that name. Paul Carlstrom, Renee Thompson, Brenda Nakamoto. Do you know any of these authors?
I don't know any of those four. I know Katrina McPherson, who's going to be there. Mm-hmm. In fact, she's driving me to the event, so I'm hoping she's going to be there.
Kelly Stanley, a mystery writer.
Uh-huh. Oh, also from Davis, right?
Yeah. All right.
And John's from Davis. Okay. Does it surprise you that there are this many successful authors in Sacramento, John?
Well, actually, the community is fantastically, prolific. It's got an incredible group of people. James Rollins is from here, and Brendan mm-hmm. Novak, and you know, literary authors in Davis. There's a woman named Spring Warren and her husband Louie, and there's just a lot of, you know, tremendous support for the arts in all ways here. And I think especially writing, it's a crazy place. It's just really a hopping, you know, creative environment.
And Lisa, you this is after all to raise money for libraries. Where do libraries fit into your life as an author?
Well, at this point, a lot of author events are being held in libraries, so they're becoming the new venue for author tours. But libraries are important because as fewer people are able to buy books, or especially hardcovers, it just brings you to a new audience, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's important in that way. But it's also, you know, the real book still exists in a library. I know that they're starting to have e-books and everything like that, but I still feel like the library is the thing that's going to keep the real book alive and encourage people to care about it.
I'm speaking with Lisa Letts and John Lacroix, who are here going to be here on Saturday night at the fundraiser for the libraries. John, how about you answer the question on what is the future of libraries, do you think?
Well, I'm hoping that it's going to be a strong future. It's always, I mean, the good news about it is that the library is not a place that's going away right now, the way, for example, all of Borders went away. There's still, you know, a real market for people who want to come in and get books out of libraries.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not changing. In fact, it's actually growing. As Lisa says, you know, authors are not usually going to bookstores anymore to do signings. Where it's just not a venue that's very productive.
Or existent.
Or existent in many ways.
Yeah.
But Barnes & Noble, you know, they're very good to keep going and keep us in hardcover and paperback books. But we are not, you know, celebrities in the sense that we draw large crowds to bookstores anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I think that game has been played. And libraries now are not just for us authors, but they're turning into community gathering places to discuss all kinds of things, for, you know, social issues and books and book clubs and things like that. And libraries just seem open to, in a way that they were not necessarily in the past. And they're really community gathering places that I think that's going to stick around.
Lisa, what's your experience of that in San Francisco?
I mean, I don't know that I can add to it, but I don't see libraries disappearing just yet. But I do think that they need to figure out new ways to sort of draw people in, because in general, people have less respect for the printed word than they did 20 years ago. And we have to figure out a way to make them more relevant. I don't have the answers. But, you know, maybe putting a Starbucks in every library might help.
I don't think that's far off. You know, corporate sponsorship is the way to go.
Well, they put them in bookstores, right?
So. Right.
Lisa, what you said a minute ago is kind of striking, that there's less respect for the printed word than there was 20 years ago. What do you mean when you say that?
Well, you know, people don't walk around with a book in hand like they used to. And, like, kids are playing video games. There's so many different things to just sort of to distract you. I mean, the internet.
Mm-hmm.
How much more time are we spending on the internet when we used to probably spend it reading?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even newspapers. Newspapers have disappeared. I mean, I know we're spending a lot of time online reading the news, but it does feel like it's in a different form.
It is a different quality of reading, isn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Is that reflected in your sales? Do you find that you're not selling as many books as you used to, or
wasn't writing 20 years ago.
Right.
So
John, how are you?
Well, my sales have been kind of holding steady in firm numbers in terms of actual people who buy each book. But the difference is now my hardcover sales have definitely dropped off, as has everybody else's in the
mm-hmm.
whole country.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully that's being made up for by ebook sales and downloads. But the download situation, this is one of the things I know Lisa and I are going to have fun talking about at the event, is, you know, the download situation for us, we make significantly less royalties.
Right.
So we can sell the same amount of books and make a lot less money.
Right.
And that's not exactly what we're hoping is going to continue.
Right. Lisa, you had something to add to that?
Well, it's not just the author who's making less money. It's the publisher making less money. And their cuts will affect the quality of the book. And then authors now, the ones who work under the traditional publishing model, are competing against the self-published authors who are selling their books for $1.99 or nothing
at
all.
Or nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a book is not a bargain if it sucks. But people don't seem to understand that.
Let's use that. Let's use that as our mantra.
Yeah,
that's a book
like
is, not a, mantra, is not a bargain
yes.
if it sucks.
Well, you, Lisa, you have a do you have a new book out?
Yes, Trail of the Spellmans, the fifth in the Spellman series is out today. Thank you.
Out today, okay.
Wow,
and John, how about you?
Yes, I have a new book out called The Hunter, and it came out on January the 3rd, made the New York Times bestseller list, and it's still available
everywhere. Congratulations, by the way.
Oh,
yeah.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
So
things are still, books are still selling.
It's going well.
And your books are still selling.
It feels like life is still good, but we're vigilant, let's put it that way.
Well, you watch the record industry, and it doesn't look so good.
Well, if you compare, you know, the music store of 20 years ago to the music store of today, there isn't any music stores today.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping that's not the case with books. But, Borders is a very ominous note that got struck in the industry, and we're hoping that B&N can keep it going and that there'll be a resurgence of independent booksellers.
That in fact, you live in Davis, and that was a factor in it. That happened in Davis, right?
Yeah,
the borders
huge.
Closed.
Yeah, it's gone. It's going to be a Whole Foods store.
well,
at least we'll be.
It could be worse
well.
Than that, I guess.
Yeah.
Right. All right. Well, I've been speaking with John Lacroix and Lisa Lutz about Saturday evening's fundraiser, The Authors on the Move. It is at the Hyatt. It starts at 5:00. Thank you so much for coming in and joining us.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
And we'll have links on our website, capradio.org/insight, for both of these authors and some others. Thanks a lot. And that's Insight for today. I'm David Watts Barton. Insight's assistant producers are James Morrison and Lynn Weaver. Today's associate producer was Sarah Jung. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. And thank you for joining us.